Douglas Aircraft, which had then become McDonnell Douglas, was slow to commit to a jumbo jet project, and it fell into yet another round of catch-up with Boeing. The DC-10, McDonnell Douglas's response, never attained the same market position as the 747. Boeing's an excellent example of how highly visionary companies often use bold missions, or what we prefer to call BHAGs, B-H-A-G, Big, Hairy, Audacious Goals, pronounced BHAGs, as a particularly powerful mechanism to stimulate progress. A BHAG is not the only powerful mechanism for stimulating progress, nor do all the visionary companies use it extensively. Nonetheless, we found more evidence of this powerful mechanism in the visionary companies and less of it in the comparison companies in 14 out of 18 cases. All companies have goals. All people have goals. All nations have goals. But there's a difference between merely having a goal and becoming committed to a huge, daunting challenge, like a big mountain to climb. Think of the moon mission in the 1960s. President Kennedy and his advisors could have gone off into a conference room and drafted something like, "Let's beef up our space program," or some other such vacuous statement. The most optimistic scientific assessment of the moon mission's chances for success in 1961 was 50-50, and most experts were in fact more pessimistic. Yet nonetheless, Congress agreed to the tune of an immediate $549 million and billions more in the following 5 years, with Kennedy's proclamation on May 25 of 1961, that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth. Given the odds, such a bold commitment was at the time outrageous. But that's what made it such a powerful mechanism for getting the United States, still groggy from the 1950s, moving vigorously forward. Like the moon mission, a true BHAG is clear and compelling, and it serves as a unifying focal point of effort, often creating immense team spirit. It has a clear finish line, so the organization can know when it has achieved the goal. People love to shoot for finish lines. A BHAG engages people. It reaches out and grabs them in the gut. It is tangible, highly energizing, focused. People get it right away. It takes little or no explanation. I mean, think about the moon mission. You didn't need a committee to spend hours wordsmithing the goal into a verbose, meaningless, impossible-to-remember mission statement. It's a simple goal. We're going to go to the moon and back by the end of the decade. The goal itself, the mountain to climb, was so easy to grasp, so compelling in its own right, that it could be said 100 different ways, but it would be easily understood by everyone. When an expedition sets out to climb Mount Everest, it doesn't need a 3-page convoluted statement to explain what Mount Everest is. So think about your own case. Do you have verbose statements floating around, yet no stimulating bold goals with the compelling clarity of the moon mission, climbing Mount Everest, or the corporate BHAGs in this chapter? Reflecting on the challenges facing General Electric, then CEO Jack Welch from the 1990s stated that the first step before all other steps is for the company to define its destiny in broad but clear terms. You need an overarching message, something big but simple and understandable. Well, what was he referring to? Like what? Well, earlier, Welch had come up with the following. The now famous become number one or number two in every market we serve, and revolutionize this company to have the speed and agility of a small enterprise. Now compare the compelling clarity of GE's BHAG with the difficult-to-understand and hard-to-remember vision statement articulated by Westinghouse in 1989. Here's the General Electric one. Become number one or number two in every market we serve, revolutionize this company to have the speed and agility of a small enterprise. Here is the Westinghouse vision statement. Total quality, market leadership, technology-driven, global, focused growth, diversified. I'll leave it to you to decide which actually would do more to stimulate progress. The point here is not that GE had the right goal, or that you should go out and do a number one or number two goal, and that Westinghouse had the wrong goal. The point is that GE's goal was clear, compelling, and more likely to stimulate progress like the moon mission did. The essential point of a BHAG is captured in such questions as, does it stimulate progress? Does it create momentum? Does it get us going? Does it get our juices flowing? Do people find it stimulating, exciting, adventurous? Are we willing to throw our creative talents and human energies into it? BHAGs are bold. They fall in the gray area where reason and prudence might say, you know, this is just a bit unreasonable, but the drive for progress says, we believe we can do it anyway. Again, these aren't just goals. These are big, hairy, audacious goals. In 1907, Henry Ford, a 43-year-old businessman, stimulated his company forward with an astounding BHAG: to democratize the automobile. Ford himself said, I will build a motor car for the great multitude. It will be so low in price that no man making a good salary will be unable to own one and enjoy with his family the blessings of hours of pleasure in God's great open spaces. Everybody will be able to afford one, and everyone will have one. The horse will have disappeared from our highways. The automobile will be taken for granted. Unfortunately for Ford, once it achieved its big hairy goal of democratizing the automobile, it didn't set a new BHAG, and it became complacent, and it watched GM set and achieve the equally audacious goal of overcoming Ford. And then GM passed Ford. And it brings me to a key point. A BHAG only helps you so long as you've not yet achieved it. Ford suffered from what we call the we've arrived syndrome, a complacent lethargy that can arise once a company has achieved one BHAG and doesn't replace it with another. Now, this brings me to something for you to think about in your own case. If you have a BHAG, you might want to think about what's next before you complete the current one. And if you find your organization or you find your company or even yourself in a state of malaise, you might ask, if you had a BHAG, either implicit or explicit, that you've attained and not yet replaced with a new one. I find it actually quite interesting. Sometimes companies achieve a goal and they don't really acknowledge it, and then they stall and they wonder, where's the energy? Why do we not have the same spirit we had before? Well, because you achieved your goal. You need a new one. Let's look at a relatively small company that made a really remarkable step for such a small company. In the late 1950s, a relatively small company, largely unknown outside of its home country, with a very difficult to pronounce name, took the costly step of discarding its original name in favor of a new one. The new name? Sony Corporation. The company's bank objected to the idea. You know, it's taken you 10 years since the company's founding to make your original name widely known in the trade. Why do you want to make a nonsensical change to a term that doesn't even connote Japan, Sony? Sony's Akio Morita responded that it would enable the company to expand worldwide. Now, you're probably thinking that such a move does not represent something particularly audacious. After all, most small to mid-sized companies eventually look to overseas markets. And it's not that big of a deal to change a corporate name from a difficult-to-pronounce Japanese name to the easy-to-pronounce Sony Corporation. But look closely at the reason Morita gave for this move. Although our company was still small, and we saw Japan as quite a large and potentially active market, it became obvious to me that if we did not set our sights on marketing abroad, we would not grow into the kind of company Ibuka and I had envisioned. We wanted to change the image around the world of Japanese products as poor in quality. Just stop and think about this for a minute. We're talking the 1950s here. In the 1950s, made in Japan meant cheap, junky, poor quality. In reading through materials on the company, we concluded that Sony not only wanted to be successful in its own right, but it wanted to become the company best known for changing the image of Japanese consumer products as being poor quality. At the time, they had less than 1,000 employees. They had no overseas presence to speak of. This was not a small goal. Walmart, like Sony, had a similar pattern of audacious BHAGs, beginning all the way back when it was a small company. In fact, when Sam Walton had his first Five and Dime store in 1945. His goal, his first BHAG, was to make his little Newport store the best, most profitable variety store in Arkansas within 5 years. And to achieve this goal required more than tripling the sales volume within that period of time. The store attained the goal, becoming the biggest, most profitable store in Arkansas and the surrounding five states. That was just one mountain. Now it's time for the next mountain. Walton continued to set similarly audacious goals for his organization decade after decade. In 1977, he set the big, hairy, audacious goal of becoming a $1 billion company in 4 years, which would be more than doubling the company's size. And he didn't stop there, setting new bold targets. In 1990, Sam Walton set the target to double the number of stores and increase the sales volume per square foot by 60% by the year 2000. Now, after publishing that example in an article, we received the following letter from a proud Walmart director. And this was directed to Jerry and me. January 10, 1992. You are correct that Sam Walton articulated a target to double the number of stores and increase the dollar volume per square foot by 60% by the fiscal year 2000. The more important point, and what was missed, is that he did set a specific target of $125 billion. At the time, the largest retailer in the world had reached $30 billion. For the year ending January 1991, Walmart reached $32.6 billion. And became the largest retailer in the United States and the world. The only corporation anywhere which has attained a volume approaching $125 billion, this is back in January of 92, is General Motors. The director then went on to say, I have been a director of Walmart stores since 1980 and have complete confidence that the target set by Sam Walton will be attained. If someone thought his original target set in 1977 was audacious, he or she must be frightened by the present target. Sincerely, Robert Kahn, Walmart Director. Now that is a BHAG. Now I remember back in an earlier chapter where I shared Walmart's remarkable scale today, that it's well over $300 billion and is on its way to being potentially the world's first $1 trillion corporation. That's $1 trillion a year. And the neat thing to keep in mind is that's just yet another mountain, and this has been going on for decades. Think all the way back to Sam Walton's first goal, to be the best, most profitable little store in the state of Arkansas. And now today going on to have a GDP that rivals the United Kingdom. It shows the power of BHAG after BHAG, and when you've got one finished, you set the next one, and you never stop climbing those mountains. It's not just having a goal that stimulates progress. It's also the level of commitment that you bring to that goal. A goal cannot be classified as a BHAG without a high level of commitment. IBM pulled ahead of rival Burroughs at critical junctures in its history via the mechanism of tangible and, at times, risky commitments to audacious goals. In particular, we point to the BHAG to reshape the computer industry in the early 1960s. IBM put itself at risk by making an all-or-nothing investment in a new computer called the IBM 360. Now, at the time, the 360 was the largest privately financed commercial project ever undertaken. It required more resources than the United States spent on the Manhattan Project to develop the first atomic bomb. Fortune magazine called the 360 IBM's $5 billion gamble, and that was back when $1 billion really meant something. Perhaps the riskiest business judgment of recent times. During the 360 introduction, IBM built up nearly $600 million of work-in-process inventory and almost needed emergency loans to meet payroll. Not only that, the 360 would obsolete most of IBM's existing products. Upon announcement of the 360, demand for IBM's existing products dried up, and the company found itself committed to a long leap across a deep canyon with no going back. If they leapt and they didn't make it to the other side, they were going to plummet into that canyon and die. If the 360 failed, then, well, it wouldn't be a pretty sight. Wrote Fortune, it was roughly as though General Motors had decided to scrap its existing makes and models and offer in their place one new line of cars covering the entire spectrum of demand with a radically redesigned engine and an exotic fuel. Tom Watson Jr., who was CEO at this time, wrote, there wasn't going to be much room for error. It was the biggest, riskiest decision I ever made, and I agonized about it for weeks. But deep down, I believed there was nothing IBM couldn't do. Watson's belief that IBM, because it was IBM, could pull this off, illustrates a key thing about BHAGs. The BHAGs looked more audacious to outsiders than to insiders. The visionary companies didn't see their audacity as taunting the gods. It simply never occurred to them that they couldn't do what they set out to do. Let's make an analogy to mountain climbing. Imagine watching a rock climber scale a cliff without a rope. If she falls, she dies. Now, from the outside, to the uninformed person, you might think this is an incredibly risky activity. My goodness, the consequences of her falling off are not going to be pretty, and I don't want to be here to pick her up when she splatters all over the rocks. But now, suppose that for this climber, she is one of the best climbers in the world, and she is on rock climbing holds that to her feel big, and the moves don't feel that hard. To the uninformed outsider, it looks risky. But you know, to the climber, it doesn't feel that risky because she's well within the zone of what she knows she can accomplish. That's the way BHAGs are. Now, earlier in this book, we talked about charismatic leadership and how you don't need a charismatic leader. And people often think that BHAGs and charismatic leaders go together. You know, you think about the moon mission, or you think about Sam Walton, and you think of John F. Kennedy, and you think of these great leaders leading people up these mountains. But actually, it's the goal that becomes motivating. Because think about in the moon mission case. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963. The goal was set in 1961. Did the goal stop? Did NASA stop? Did we fail to reach the moon simply because Kennedy was no longer with us? No, of course not. The genius of it is that the goal itself is motivation. The goal itself drives progress. And even if the leader leaves, the goal is there to keep the company going. And that was the secret behind what Sam Walton did when he put in place that $125 billion goal by the year 2000. He knew he was going to be dead long before that goal came about. But the goal would be there like the moon mission, leading the company forward, even if he was not there leading the company forward. The goal, the mechanism, the ticking clock, not the leader. Clock building, not time telling. Now, we've covered most of the key points about BHAGs in this chapter, but I want to kind of pull out some key points you can take away as you think about your own BHAGs. Number one, a BHAG should be so clear and compelling that it requires no explanation. Remember, it's like climbing a mountain or going to the moon. It's not a statement, it's a goal. And if it doesn't get people's juices going, then it's just not a BHAG. Two, a BHAG should fall well outside of your comfort zone. People in the organization should have reason to believe they can pull it off, like IBM did with the 360, like Boeing did with the 747. Yet it should also require heroic effort and perhaps even a little bit of luck, as was also the case with the 360 and the 707. Number three, a BHAG should be so bold and exciting in its own right that it would continue to stimulate progress even if the leaders who set the goal disappeared before it had been completed, as was the case with the moon mission in Kennedy and the $125 billion with Sam Walton. Number four, a BHAG has the inherent danger that once you've achieved it, you can stall and drift in what we call the we've arrived syndrome, as happened with Ford in the 1920s. You have to be prepared to prevent this by having follow-on BHAGs. What's the next mountain? What's the next Mount Everest once you've conquered one? You need to have the next one queued up to go. Five, your BHAG should be consistent with your core ideology. Now, I'd like to insert a sixth point about BHAGs that only became clear after we'd published Built to Last. As exciting as BHAGs are, we left a vital question unanswered. What's the difference between a bad BHAG and a good BHAG? You know, not all audacious goals are good audacious goals. Swimming from Australia to New Zealand, that would be a BHAG for me. But I would also drown and it would kill me. So therefore, I would say it's probably a bad BHAG. BHAGs that tend to kill you tend not to qualify in the good category. In a later piece of research, which became Good to Great, which was done after Built to Last, we wrestled with this question and we made a discovery. And the discovery is that bad BHAGs are set with bravado, and good BHAGs are set with understanding. an understanding in particular of three key variables, or what we came to call the three circles of the hedgehog concept back in Good to Great. These three circles are: one, understanding what you are deeply passionate about, which includes your core ideology. Circle two, understanding what you can be the best in the world at. Not what you want to be the best in the world at, not what you hope to be the best in the world at, but piercing clarity about what you can be the best in the world at. And circle three, deep understanding about what best drives your economic or resource engine. And you want to think of a good BHAG as one that falls in the middle of those three circles. That the 747 was a good BHAG because A, it really fit with what the Boeing people were deeply passionate about. It fit with what they could be the best in the world at. They had all that military experience, and they built big bombers, and they built jets. They knew how to do it. They could be the best in the world at big commercial jet aircraft. They understood that this would best drive their economic engine, because in fact, as the world was moving to commercial and there was an intersection with jets and the military market was declining, it in fact made immense economic sense to do the 707, the 747, and so forth. So it wasn't any random goal at Boeing. It was a BHAG that reflected what you're passionate about, what you can be the best at, and what drives your economic engine. Any BHAG that meets those tests is more likely to be a good BHAG rather than a bad BHAG. Preserve the core and stimulate progress again. BHAGs alone do not make a visionary company. Indeed, progress alone, no matter what the mechanisms used to stimulate that progress, does not make a visionary company. You have to be careful to preserve your core while pursuing your BHAGs. Revolutionizing the railroad business would certainly have been a BHAG for Ford in 1909. But Ford wasn't about railroads. It was about cars, and they were passionate about and loved cars. Creating the cheapest radios in history, regardless of quality or innovation, would certainly have been a BHAG for Sony in 1950, but it wouldn't have fit with Sony's self-image as pioneers of innovation and key players in the task of elevating Japan's status in the world. Yes, any BHAG exciting to people would stimulate change and improvement. But the BHAGs should also be a powerful statement of your company's core ideology. In fact, BHAGs can help to reinforce one of the key sets of mechanisms for preserving the core ideology, a cult-like culture, the subject of our next chapter. To defy the odds, to take on big hairy challenges, especially if rooted in an ideology, does much to make people feel that they belong to something special, elite, different, better. We return once again to a key aspect of a visionary company, the powerful interplay between core ideology and the drive for progress, which exist together like the yin and yang of Chinese dualistic philosophy. Each element complements and reinforces the other. Indeed, the core ideology enables progress by providing a base of continuity from which a visionary company can launch the corporate equivalent of the moon mission. But likewise, progress enables the core ideology, for without change and movement forward, the company will eventually cease to be viable. Again, it's not either core values or progress. It's not even a nice balance between core and progress, but rather two powerful elements inextricably linked and both working at full force to the ultimate benefit of the institution.
Chapter 6. Cult-like cultures. Now, I want you to raise your right hand and remember what we say here at Walmart, that a promise we make is a promise we keep. And I want you to repeat after me. From this day forward, I solemnly promise and declare that every time a customer comes within 10 feet of me, I will smile, look him in the eye, and greet him. So help me, Sam. This was said by Sam Walton to over 100,000 Walmart associates via TV satellite link-up in the mid-1980s. So why do you want to work at Nordstrom? The interviewer asks. Because my friend Laura tells me it's the best place she's ever worked, Robert responds. She gushes about the excitement of working with the very best, being part of the elite of the elite. She's almost a missionary for you folks, very proud to call herself a Nordstrom employee. And she's been rewarded well. Laura started in the stockroom 8 years ago, and now she gets to manage an entire store. She's only 29. She told me that people here make a lot more than salespeople at other stores, and that the best salespeople working on the floor can make over $80,000 a year. Yes, it's true that you can make more money here than working at other department stores. Our salespeople generally make almost double the national average for retail sales clerks, and a few make a lot more than that. But you know, of course, not everyone has what it takes to really make it here as a member of the Nordstrom corporate family, explains the interviewer. We're selective, and a lot don't make it. You prove yourself at every level, or you leave. Yes, I've heard that 50% of the new hires are gone after 1 year. Something like that. Those who don't like the pressure and the hard work, and who don't buy into our system and values, they're gone. But if you have the drive, initiative, and above all else, the ability to produce and serve the customer, then you'll do well. The key question is whether Nordstrom is right for you. If not, you'll probably hate it here, fail miserably, and leave. What positions would I be eligible for? The same as every other new hire. You start at the bottom, working the stockroom and the sales floor. But I have a bachelor's degree, Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Washington. Other companies will let me begin as a management trainee. Not here. Everybody starts at the bottom. Mr. Bruce, Mr. Jim, and Mr. John, three Nordstrom brothers that make up the chairman's office, they all started on the floor. Mr. Bruce likes to remind us that he and his brothers were all raised sitting on a shoe sales stool in front of the customer. It's a literal and figurative posture that we all keep in mind. You get a lot of operational freedom here. No one will be directing your every move, and you're only limited by your ability to perform within the bounds of the Nordstrom way, of course. But if you're not willing to do whatever it takes to make a customer happy, to personally deliver a suit to his hotel room, get down on your knees to fit a shoe, force yourself to smile when a customer is a real jerk, then you just don't belong here, period. Nobody tells you to be a customer service hero. It's just sort of expected. Robert took the job at Nordstrom, excited at the prospect of joining something special, thrilled to be at the place to work. He was proud to receive personalized professional business cards rather than a name tag. The handout depicting Nordstrom's company structure as an upside-down pyramid made him feel even more important. He also received a copy of Nordstrom's employee handbook, which consisted of a single 5-inch by 8-inch card and read in its entirety, "Welcome to Nordstrom. We're glad to have you with our company. Our number one goal is to provide outstanding customer service. Set both your personal and professional goals high. We have great confidence in your ability to achieve them. Nordstrom rules. Rule number one, use your good judgment in all situations. There will be no additional rules. Please feel free to ask your department manager, store manager, or division general manager any question at any time." During his first few months, Robert became immersed in the world of a dedicated Nordy, as many employees call themselves. He found that he spent most of his time either at the store, at Nordy functions, or socializing with other Nordys. They became his support group. He heard dozens of stories about heroic customer service. The Nordy who ironed a new-bought shirt for a customer who needed it for a meeting that afternoon. The Nordy who cheerfully gift-wrapped products a customer bought at Macy's. The Nordy who warmed customer cars in winter while the customer finished shopping. The Nordy who personally knit a shawl for an elderly customer who needed one of special length that wouldn't get caught in the spokes of her wheelchair. The Nordy who made a last-minute delivery of party clothes to a frantic hostess. And even the Nordy who refunded money for a set of tire chains, although Nordstrom doesn't sell tire chains. He learned about the notes called heroics that Nordstrom salespeople wrote about each other and that were used, along with customer letters and employee thank you notes to customers, to determine which stores should receive monthly prizes for the best service. His manager explained about the all-important customer letters. Customer letters are real important around here. You never, ever want to get a bad one. That's a real sin. But good ones can lead you to become a customer service all-star. You think Phi Beta Kappa was a big deal? But to become a customer service all-star, now that's a really big deal. You get a personal handshake from one of the Nordstrom brothers. Your picture goes on the wall, and you get prizes and discounts. It makes you the top of the top. And if you become a productivity winner, you become a pace setter, complete with new business cards so designated and 33% merchandise discounts. Only our very top people become pace setters. Oh, well, how do I become a pace setter? Robert asked. Simple. You set very high sales goals and then you exceed them, she explained. Then she asked, by the way, what are your goals for today? Sales goals, productivity, achievement. Robert noticed reminders posted on the walls in the employee back rooms. Make a daily to-do list, or list goals, set priorities, or don't let us down, or be a top dog, pace setter, go for the milk bones. He learned quickly about the all-important SPH, sales per hour, calculation. If you exceed your target SPH, you'll get a 10% commission on net sales, his manager explained. If not, you'll just get your base hourly wage rate. And if you have a high SPH, you'll get to work more attractive hours and have better odds of being promoted. You can track your SPH on the computer printouts we keep in the back office. We list all the SPHs in rank order so you can keep track and make sure you're not falling behind. Your SPH will also appear on your pay stub. At the end of the first pay period, employees gathered around a bulletin board in the back room on which was posted a ranking of SPH by employee number. A few had dropped below a red line marked on the paper. Robert quickly understood that he should do all he could to avoid falling behind. He woke up one night in a cold sweat from a vivid nightmare of walking into the back room and seeing his name at the bottom of the list. He worked furiously during the day to not be left behind by his peers. Soon after the first pay period, Robert noticed that one of the salespeople in his area had left work early. "Where's John?" he asked. "Sent home for the day. Penalized for getting irritated with a customer," said Bill, a fellow salesperson who had won a recent smile contest and thereby got his picture on the wall. "It's kind of like being sent to your room without dinner." At age 26, Bill was already a 5-year Nordstrom veteran, a pace setter, and an all-star. Bill clearly had that rare what-it-takes quality to thrive at Nordstrom. "When people shop at Nordstrom, they deserve the best attitude," he explained. "I always have my smile for anybody, everybody." Bill dressed almost exclusively in Nordstrom clothes, and in addition to the smile contest, he'd also won a Who Looks the Most Nordstrom contest the prior year. He basked in the glory of public praise one day as the store manager read aloud a letter about Bill from a satisfied customer. To the applause and cheers of fellow employees, Bill loved his job at Nordstrom. "Where else could I get paid so well and have so much autonomy? Nordstrom is one of the first places I've ever felt like I really belong to something special. Sure, I work really hard, but I like to work hard. No one tells me what to do, and I feel I can go as far as my dedication will take me. I feel like an entrepreneur." Bill had earlier moved, along with over 100 other Nordstrom people, from Nordstrom stores on the West Coast to one of its new store openings on the East Coast. "We wouldn't want non-Nordies to open a new store, even if it's all the way across the country," he explained. He described the excitement of opening day. "Employees were clapping. Customers came in, and they were clapping too. There was so much energy and adrenaline flowing. It was an emotional, look what I'm part of atmosphere that made you feel really special." Bill was a great Nordy role model for Robert. He told Robert about how he attended a Nordstrom motivational seminar where he learned to write upbeat affirmations, which he repeated over and over to himself. "I feel proud to be a pace setter." Bill had the goal of becoming a store manager, so he chanted to himself the affirmation, "I enjoy being a store manager at Nordstrom. I enjoy being a store manager at Nordstrom. I enjoy being a store manager at Nordstrom." Bill explained that being a Nordstrom manager would be tough and demanding. He described how store managers must publicly declare their sales goals at quarterly meetings. "Mr. John, he sometimes wears a sweater with a giant N on the front and stirs up the crowd. Then someone unveils the sales targets for each store set by a secret committee. I've heard that those managers who set goals below those set by the secret committee get booed. Those who set goals higher than the committee get cheered." Bill was also a great source of information and guidance about the Nordstrom way. "Be very careful about talking to outsiders," Bill cautioned. "The company's very sensitive about its privacy and likes to keep tight control on what information goes to the outside world. That comes from the top. How we do things around here is not anybody else's business." "By the way," Bill asked as they were closing up shop late one evening, "did you know that we had a secret shopper in here today?" "A what?" "A secret shopper. That's a Nordstrom employee who pretends to be a customer, secretly, and checks on your demeanor and service. She came by you today. I think you did fine, but watch the frown. You have a tendency to frown when you're working hard. Just remember to smile. Don't frown. A frown can be a black mark on your file. Rule number two, Robert thought to himself, don't frown. Be happy. Over the following 6 months, Robert found himself increasingly uncomfortable at Nordstrom. When he found himself at a 7 a.m. department meeting with Nordies chanting, "We're number one, and we want to do it for Nordstrom," he thought back to the opening paragraph of the write-up on Nordstrom in the Best 100 Companies to Work for in America, which said, "If you don't like to work in a gung-ho atmosphere where people are always revved up, then this is not the place for you." He found himself doing okay, never falling to the bottom of the SPH listings, but tellingly, not great. He'd never received a handshake from Mr. Jim or Mr. John or Mr. Bruce. He had not become a pace setter or an all-star, and feared that he would once again frown for a secret shopper or that he might get a negative customer letter. And worst of all, he was being left behind by those who were just much more Nordstrom than he. They had the right Nordstrom stuff. He didn't. He just didn't fit. Robert quit 11 months into his career at Nordstrom. A year later, however, he was thriving as a department manager at another store. "Nordstrom was a great experience, but it wasn't for me," he explained. "I know some of my friends are incredibly happy there. They really love it. And there's no doubt about it, Nordstrom's a really great company. But I fit better here." Robert is a composite character we created to illustrate this chapter, based on interviews with employees and ex-employees, transcript notes from an interview with co-chairman Jim Nordstrom, company documents, book excerpts, and articles. Ejected like a virus. When we began our research project, we speculated that our evidence would show the visionary companies to be great places to work, or at least better places to work than the comparison companies. However, we didn't find this to be the case, at least not for everyone. Recall how well Bill and Laura fit and flourished at Nordstrom. For them, it was a truly great place to work. But notice how Robert just couldn't fully buy in. For him, Nordstrom was not a great place to work. Nordstrom is only a great place to work for those truly dedicated and well-suited to the Nordstrom way. The same is true for many of the other visionary companies we studied. We learned that you don't need to create a soft or comfortable environment to build a visionary company. Visionary companies tend to be more demanding of their people than other companies, both in terms of performance and congruence with the ideology. Visionary, we learn, does not mean soft and undisciplined. Quite the contrary. Because the visionary companies have such clarity about who they are, what they're all about, and what they're trying to achieve, they tend to not have much room for people unwilling or unsuited to their demanding standards. During a research meeting, one of our research assistants made the observation, "Joining these companies reminds me of joining an extremely tight-knit group or society. And if you don't fit, you'd better not join. If you're willing to really buy in and dedicate yourself to what the company stands for, then you'll be very satisfied and productive. Probably couldn't be happier. If not, however, you'll probably flounder, feel miserable and out of place, and eventually leave, ejected like a virus. It's binary. You're either in or you're out, and there seems to be no middle ground. It's almost cult-like." Please don't misunderstand our point here. We're not saying that visionary companies are cults. We're saying that they are more cult-like without actually being cults. The term cultism and cult-like can conjure up a variety of negative images and connotations. It's a much stronger word than culture. But to merely say that visionary companies have a culture tells us nothing new or interesting. All companies have a culture. We observe something much stronger than just culture at work. An analysis of the visionary versus comparison companies revealed the following. In 11 out of the 18 pairs, the evidence shows stronger indoctrination into a core ideology throughout the history of the visionary company than the comparison company. In 13 out of 18 pairs, the evidence shows greater tightness of fit throughout the history of the visionary company than in the comparison company. People tend to either fit well with the company and its ideology or tend to not fit at all. Buy in or get out. In 13 out of the 18 pairs, the evidence shows greater elitism, a sense of belonging to something special and superior throughout the history of the visionary company. Summing up across all three dimensions, indoctrination, tightness of fit, and elitism, the visionary companies have shown stronger cult-like cultures throughout their history than the comparison companies in 14 out of the 18 pairs. Four pairs were indistinguishable. IBM's rise to greatness. Thomas J. Watson Jr., former IBM chief executive, described the environment at IBM during its rise to national prominence in the first half of the 20th century as a cult-like atmosphere. This atmosphere traces back to 1914, when Watson's father, Thomas J. Watson Sr., became chief executive of the small, struggling company and consciously set about to create an organization of dedicated zealots. Watson plastered the wall with slogans. Time lost is time gone forever. There is no such thing as standing still. We must never feel satisfied. We sell service. A company is known by the men it keeps. He instituted strict rules of personal conduct. He required salespeople to be well-groomed and wear dark business suits. Encouraged marriage. Married people, in his view, work harder and were more loyal because they had to provide for a family. Discouraged smoking and forbade alcohol. Watson instituted training programs to systematically indoctrinate new hires into the corporate philosophy, sought to hire young and impressionable people, and adhered to a strict promote-from-within practice. Later, he created IBM-managed country clubs to encourage IBMers to socialize primarily with other IBMers, not the outside world. Similar to Nordstrom, IBM sought to create a heroic mythology about employees who best exemplified the corporate ideology and placed their names and pictures, along with stories of their heroic deeds, in company publications. A few exemplars even had corporate songs composed in their honor. And also like Nordstrom, IBM emphasized the importance of individual effort and initiative within the context of the collective effort. Veteran employees in regulation IBM clothes taught classes and emphasized IBM values. Each morning, surrounded by posters with corporate mottos and slogans, students would rise and sing IBM songs out of a songbook, Songs of the IBM, which included The Star-Spangled Banner and, on the facing page, IBM's own anthem, Ever Onward. Although IBM eventually evolved beyond singing corporate songs, it retained its intensely values-oriented training and socialization processes. IBM's profile in the 1985 edition of the 100 Best Companies to Work For described IBM as a company that has institutionalized its beliefs the way a church does. The result is a company filled with ardent believers. If you're not ardent, you may not be comfortable. Some have compared joining IBM with joining a religious order or going into the military. If you understand the Marines, you understand IBM. You must be willing to give up some of your individual identity to survive. A 1982 Wall Street Journal article noted that the IBM culture is so pervasive that, as one 9-year former employee put it, leaving the company was like emigrating. You might be wondering whether IBM's cult-like atmosphere and tight adherence to its three basic beliefs contributed to IBM's difficulties in the early 1990s. Was cultism a primary cause of IBM's difficulty to adapt to the dramatic changes in the computer industry? Upon close inspection, the evidence does not support this view. IBM was strongly cult-like in the 1920s, yet was able to adapt to the dramatic shift to automated accounting procedures. IBM was incredibly cult-like in the 1930s, yet was able to adapt to the demands of the Depression without a single layoff. IBM maintained its cult-like culture in the 1950s and 60s, yet was able to adapt to the rise of computers, perhaps the most dramatic shift in IBM's history. IBM still had a cultish feel in the early 1980s, yet, unlike any other old-line computer company, adapted to the personal computer revolution and established itself as a major player. If anything, IBM's cult-like culture, its fanatical preservation of its core values, declined as the company headed toward trouble. IBM attained its greatest success and displayed its greatest ability to adapt to a changing world during the same era that it displayed its strongest cult-like culture. The magic of Walt Disney. Like IBM and Nordstrom, the Walt Disney Company has made extensive use of indoctrination, tightness of fit, and elitism as key parts of preserving its core ideology. All new hires at Disneyland experience a multi-day training program where they quickly learn a new language. Employees are cast members. Customers are guests. A crowd is an audience. A work shift is a performance. A job is a part. A job description is a script. A uniform is a costume. The personnel department is casting. Being on duty is being on stage. Being off duty is being backstage. The special language reinforces the frame of mind Disney imposes via carefully scripted orientation seminars delivered by well-practiced trainers who drill new cast members with questions about Disney characters, history, and mythology, and who constantly reinforce the underlying ideology. Here's an example. Trainer, what business are we in? Everybody knows McDonald's makes hamburgers. What does Disney make? New hire, it makes people happy. Trainer, yes, exactly. It makes people happy. It doesn't matter who they are, what language they speak, what they do, where they come from, what color they are, or anything else. We're here to make them happy. Nobody's been hired for a job. Everybody's been cast for a role in our show. The orientation seminars take place in specially designed training rooms plastered with pictures of founder Walt Disney and his most famous characters, Mickey Mouse, Snow White, the Seven Dwarfs, etc. They aim, in the words of a Tom Peters group video, to create the illusion that Walt himself is present in the room, welcoming the new hires to his personal domain. The object is to make these new employees feel like partners with the park's founder. Employees read from the Disney University textbooks, which have included such exhortations as, "At Disneyland, we get tired but never bored. And even if it's a rough day, we appear happy. You've got to have an honest smile. It's got to come from within. If nothing else helps, remember that you get paid for smiling." Disney's fanatical preservation of its self-image and ideology has shown itself most clearly in its theme parks, but it also extends far beyond the theme parks. A Stanford MBA who spent a summer at Disney doing financial analysis, strategic planning, and similar MBA-type work described Disney this way. "I recognized the magic of Walt's vision on my first day at the Walt Disney Company. At Disney University, through videos and pixie dust, Walt shared his dreams and the magic of Disney's world. Disney archives treasure Walt's history for cast members to enjoy. After orientation, I stopped at the corner of Mickey Avenue and Dopey Drive. I felt the magic, the sentimentality, the history. I believed in Walt's dream and shared this belief with others in the organization." Disney shrouds much of its inner workings in secrecy, which further contributes to a sense of mystery and elitism. Only those deep on the inside get to peek behind the curtain to see the mechanics of the magic. Writers who cover Disney have encountered fiercely protective gatekeepers to the secrets of the Magic Kingdom. "Disney is a strangely closed corporation," wrote one author. "It has a level of controlling paranoia I had never encountered in my years of writing about American business. Disney's intensive screening and indoctrination of employees, its obsession with secrecy and control, and its careful cultivation of a mythology and image as something special and important to the lives of children around the world all help to create a cultish following that extends even to its customers. A loyal Disney customer once noticed a slightly discolored Disney character doll at a retail store and seethed. If Uncle Walt saw that, he'd be ashamed. Indeed, when examining Disney, it can be hard to keep in mind that it is a corporation, not a social or religious movement. Joe Flower wrote in his book, Prince of the Magic Kingdom, "This is not a corporate history. It is a history of a deeply human struggle over ideas, values, and hopes for which men and women were willing to give themselves over. Values at times so evanescent that some people could dismiss them as silly. Values so deep that others became students of them, dedicated their careers to making them come alive, became enraged and embittered when they seemed to be violated, and turned poetic and inspired in their defense. This is what is impressive about the name Disney. No one is neutral. Walt Disney was a genius or a charlatan, a hypocrite or an exemplar, a snake oil salesman or a beloved father figure to generations of children. Walt had a rage for order and control that he translated into tangible practices to maintain the essence of Disney. The personal grooming code, the recruiting and training processes, the fanatical attention to the tiniest details of physical layout, the concern with secrecy, the exacting rules about preserving the integrity and sanctity of each Disney character. These all trace their roots to Walt's quest to keep the Disney Company completely within the bounds of its core ideology. Columbia Pictures, in contrast, had neither a core ideology nor any core preservation mechanisms in place after Cohn's death in 1958. Walt didn't build a perfectly ticking clock, but he did have a core ideology, and he did clock build mechanisms, however cultish, to preserve the core ideology. Cohn did not. Disney eventually rebounded after Walt's death as an independent institution built on his legacy. Columbia Pictures ceased to exist as an independent company. You might find yourself somewhat uncomfortable with the findings in this chapter. We too share some of that discomfort, and we wish to be clear that we're certainly not advocating or even describing the extreme Jim Jones, David Koresh, or Reverend Sun Myung Moon type of situation. It is important to understand that unlike many religious sects or social movements which often revolve around a charismatic cult leader, a cult of personality, visionary companies tend to be cult-like around their ideologies. The point of this chapter is not that you should set out to create a cult of personality. That's the last thing you should do. At this point, you might be thinking, but isn't a tight, cult-like culture dangerous? Does it lead to groupthink and stagnation? Does it drive away talented people? Does it stifle creativity and diversity? Does it inhibit change? Our answer, yes. A cult-like culture can be dangerous and limiting if not complemented with the other side of the yin-yang. Cult-like cultures which preserve the core must be counterweighted with a huge dose of stimulating progress. In a visionary company, they go hand in hand, each side reinforcing the other. A cult-like culture can actually enhance a company's ability to pursue big, hairy, audacious goals, precisely because it creates that sense of being part of an elite organization that can accomplish just about anything. IBM's cultish sense of itself contributed greatly to its ability to gamble on the IBM 360 and to reinvigorate itself in the 1990s. Furthermore, it's important to understand that you can have a cult-like culture of innovation, or a cult-like culture of competition, or a cult-like culture of change. You can even have a cult-like culture of zaniness. We think that's exactly what executives at Walmart do through such actions as leading thousands of screaming associates in the Walmart cheer. Give me a W. Give me an A. Give me an L. Give me a squiggly. Hear the employees twist and wiggle their hips. Give me an M. Give me an A. Give me an R. Give me a T. What's that spell? Walmart. What's that spell? Walmart. Who's number one? The customer. Cult-like tightness and diversity can also work hand in hand. Some of the most cult-like visionary companies have received accolades as being the best major corporations for women and minorities. Merck, for example, has a long track record of progressive equal opportunity programs. At Merck, diversity is a form of progress that nicely complements its deeply cherished core. You can be any color, size, shape, or gender at Merck, just so long as you believe in what the company stands for. In a classic example of the genius of the and, visionary companies impose tight values fit and simultaneously provide wide operating autonomy that encourages individual initiative. In fact, as we will discuss in the next chapter, we found that the visionary companies were significantly more decentralized and granted greater operational autonomy than the comparison companies as a general pattern, even though they have been much more cult-like. Recall the Nordstrom one-page employee handbook described at the beginning of this chapter. Notice how, on the one hand, the company constricts behavior to that consistent with the Nordstrom values, yet on the other hand, it grants immense operating discretion. When asked during a visit to a Stanford Business School class,